Hi, this is Neil Worley from Worley's Cider in England, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 26. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincoller, and I am your Cider MC. This is a weekly podcast where we speak to cider makers, enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week, we are chatting with Neil Worley of Worley Cider in Somerset, England, and he'll be sharing his tips on keeving cider, which is a very specific cider-making technique, and I am thrilled to bring it to Ciderville for all of you to get in on this amazing process. This chat was recorded earlier this year at CiderCon in Portland, Oregon. So thank you to the United States Association of Cider Makers for having Neil there at the conference. He was a presenter, did a little ditty on yeast, spoke with all the UK cider makers and myself. And stay tuned to the very end of this to get a little peek of what he said about Cider Chat at the very end of this podcast. We'll be getting to Neil in just a moment. I received a lovely email from Kurt Billingsley of Big Fish Cider Company in Monterey, Virginia. And he wrote, "Hi Rhea, I recently, quote, discovered, unquote, your podcast." I think that's a Simpson reference, like, I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess. "I recently discovered your podcast, and since I am tucked away deep in the mountains of Virginia, in the least populated county east of the Mississippi, I love to have that glimpse into Ciderville I otherwise don't have a chance to visit." Wow, that sounds way out there, and I imagine it's super beautiful. So he is looking forward to upcoming episodes and hearing old episodes that are new to him. You know, what is true for Kurt is probably true for many folks, is that they don't even know that Cider Chat exists. And podcasts overall can be a little cantankerous for folks because they don't really know how to download them to their smartphone or sync in and subscribe. So I'm going to ask you, Ciderville, please share this podcast and let folks know how to do that. Sometimes I actually take the person's phone and say, well, I don't take it and go running away. Obviously, I just say, may I look at your phone and show you where the podcast app is? And on the iPhone, you probably know it's that little thing that looks like a radio tower, kind of like a person radio tower morphed together. And for Android phones, a good little podcast app to have is Stitcher. So share that with your family and buddies, especially for those of you who are cider makers and you're still trying to reach out to the world and get people informed. Why not just put up a little sign at your place that says, hey, check out this podcast, Cider Chat. Especially those of you who have already been on the podcast, that would be swell for all of us. It informs people and gets them in the cider swing, which might be a whole new dance thing that we'll do at the next CiderCon or something, the cider swing. It doesn't just have to do with just swinging your arm back and forth, but it could if there's a full cup of cider in there. Anyways, thank you, Kurt, so much for writing. And you could send me an email too. Please do, Rhea, that is R-I-A, at ciderchat.com. I am really excited to share this chat with you on keeving cider with Neil Worley. Now, what is keeving? It's an interesting technique that's been around in cider making for a very long time, and Neil will be explaining a bit of that. But in short form, what happens is that the apple juice that is pressed, before it gets fermented, you keeve it. And that is a process where the nutrients drop out of the juice. And I say drop out, but in essence, what happens is they rise up to the top of the liquid and form a brown cap that Neil calls or says looks like a brown omelet. I guess it gets pretty stiff, that little cap, and you have to make a little hole through it and siphon out that juice. Now, it hasn't fermented yet, technically, The next step is to begin the fermentation, and since there's very little nutrients in this liquid, the yeast don't gobble up all the sugar. And so you're left with this amazingly refreshing, has a little bit of that residual sugar there, but not over the top. And those are natural sugars in there. They are not added in. It's an amazing, delectable cider to have. And I'm just so excited to get all these fine tips that Neil is sharing with all of us. At the end of this chat, I'll be sharing with you how you could get your own hard copy of this chat to get the background and technical information that he's sharing with all of us in Ciderville. In the meantime, let's all grab a glass and join this chat with the Worley cider maker himself, Neil, from Somerset, England.
Worley Cider is located in an area of the country called Somerset, which is a county. We are in the southwest part of Great Britain. So we are probably about 120 miles from London. It's a fairly rural area. In particular, we are in mid-Somerset, in an area called the Mendips, which is a low range of hills that fairly much leads all the way down to the Bristol Channel of the Atlantic. And in particular, where we are around about 1,000 feet above sea level. And we work on a fairly remote farm by UK standards, and if you climb the hill from the farm you can pretty much see the Bristol Channel. Wow. So that does dictate what we do up there. It has an impact on our cider making.
How so?
For a start, we don't grow any of our own fruit because up there the soil is about 3 inches deep and over lies a great big lump of limestone.
Wow.
So it's very, very poor growing conditions for fruit trees. But luckily we are right on the edge of the Somerset Levels, which is probably the largest area of cider apple growing in the whole of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So we have access to phenomenal quantities of great quality fruit, some mm-hmm. brilliant varieties.
Mm-hmm.
So from our perspective, that's not really much of an issue, not growing our own fruit. Also, because we're so high up, it's quite a cool environment in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I specifically believe that that does have an impact on what we do,
mm-hmm.
because it means it's easier for us to conduct very slow ambient temperature fermentations.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe it probably has an impact on what natural flora, i.e. yeast, mm-hmm. strains of yeast species mm-hmm. have become our house yeasts, if you like.
Nice.
So they are obviously likely to be more cryotolerant than perhaps cider makers who do work down on the levels where it's generally a good probably 5, 6, 7, 8 degrees centigrade warmer. Often during the daytime. So I suspect that contributes to the flavour profile of what we actually make.
Yeah, that's a benefit for sure. Now, in your room that you are fermenting the cider, can you give us a little bit of an image of what that's like? Is that in a barn? Or and you were talking about wild fermentation here, spontaneous fermentation,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. So we have probably three separate buildings. The pressing side of the operation goes on in a tall, they're called Dutch barns in the UK. They've got rounded metal roofs, almost like an air raid shelter or something.
Right, we call it like a hangar, or a Quonset hut is another word
okay.
for it. Right.
But it's got quite a high roof.
Yeah. But you said pressing, so you are pressing the apples on site.
Yes.
So you're transporting, instead of transporting in juice, you're bringing in apples. You must be doing that for a specific reason.
Because in my opinion, the only way that you can, that we can make the cider that we want to make is by totally controlling the varieties that we're using and the proportions that we're using them in and the condition that they're in mm-hmm. and when they're pressed. So yes, the way we operate is we are in touch with growers. Mm-hmm. We seek out particular types of orchard. Luckily, there are still quite a few orchards. They're commercial orchards, but they were planted in the 1970s by a particular cider company that was in existence at that time.
Oh.
And they used to make cider in the same way that we work now. So,
what was their name?
That was the Taunton Cider Company.
Oh, wow.
And they had a very switched-on orcharding manager. So the orchards that he planted in the 1970s are a fantastic resource for us because a modern orchard in our area will probably have three cider apple varieties as a maximum. And these sort of Taunton Cider Orchard orchards tended to have around about 18 different varieties, and they cover the whole spectrum of different types of fruits that we use. So yes, we press on site because that means I'm then free to go and choose exactly the fruit that I want to work with, and as I say, it's not very far from where we are.
How many kilometres would it be? I'm just kind of curious on the transportation kind of piece.
The haulage by tractor.
Oh, by tractor.
Tractor and trailer.
Okay.
So we tend to get 10 or 12 ton deliveries at a time, and the trip from the orchard to where we are will normally take in the region of an hour by tractor. So that gives you an idea. It's not very far.
Right. Not bad at all.
And we have a couple of apple pits, so the trailers are unloaded directly into our kind of silos, if you like.
Right.
And from there, they enter the start of the pressing process. And obviously, we need to bear in mind here that all our fruit is collected from the floor.
Right. And that means from the ground.
From the ground, right, and that's unique to the UK. They fall at the moment, I think, yes, probably. Well, I'm not sure.
Maybe other places
in Europe will do it. I don't think it's very widespread in the US.
No, not at all.
Although I'm led to believe by some people that it is legal to make cider from fruit that's hit the floor in the US.
That gets washed.
But it's not being done very much.
Right.
And actually, this feeds into part of the way that we work. For a start, generally speaking, we want our fruit to hit the floor naturally, so it's not shaken.
Mm.
Sometimes there has to be a bit of a compromise on that because of the nature of some trees. They don't all drop at the same time, so perhaps we will get a mixture of some that's dropped and some that's shaken. But what we're looking for is ripeness.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be pressing at the moment of peak ripeness. For a number of reasons, because for a start, that means that they are very ripe, so most of the most of the starch has turned to sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we tend to get better flavours developing.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, the ripening process does use up nutrient, so that means that it helps us in our aim of using low nutrient fruit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in order for all those things to fall into alignment, we have to be able to control what varieties we get, when they arrive, what state they're in, how ripe they are.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, the growers that we work with are very amenable to our requirements. We do tend to pay a little bit more for fruit than the big mills will pay. And I think we are making products that some of the growers are like to feel that their fruit is associated with.
Right.
So that's kind of, I guess, why we get some cooperation from them.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, of course, the apples are in our silo. So then that's when we start to... the pressing process, start to move into the pressing process, and that happens in that steel barn.
And that also allows you to like let the apple sweat a bit if need be. And really kind of monitor right at that exact moment that you want to press. And that's really kind of like, I think, the best of all perfect worlds.
It is. And we have that's why we have two separate areas for storing fruit. Because if a load comes in and it isn't quite ready, which does happen from time to time, we are able to leave it and work with the other storage area until that's ready to go.
So you have that pressing barn.
We have a pressing barn, so that's a kind of a corrugated steel building with a very high roof, which means that even in the summer, the heat of the sun is in the roof of the building and not down at ground level. So we can still, it's got concrete floors, so that helps to keep the cider cool, and it's in the dark.
Yeah. So you press and you're finishing or fermenting the cider there, and that's all in that same room.
Some of our fermentation goes on in there.
Right.
There isn't really enough room for all of it to go on in there, so we've recently taken on... Our other two buildings are both former winter housing quarters for dairy cattle. So they have had to be renovated, and that was a fair amount of work. So all the floors had to be dug out and reconcreted. And this year, all the roofs have been replaced. The tiles and they've been changed to a tiled roof.
Nice.
And they are very old stone buildings made from local limestone.
Oh, lovely.
And the walls are about 3 foot thick.
Wow.
And although it's not got a very high roof, they are fairly good at keeping cool during the summer because the thermal mass of the concrete floors and the stone walls provide a nice cool environment.
Lovely, yeah.
So we've got two of those buildings. And one of them, as I say, we took over just this year, and that is where we have started doing the majority of our fermenting this year for the first time. And our other building is, as I say, it's the other cow shed, and that's what we tend to use as a warehouse. And we do then have actually a little tiny bit of another barn, which is a tasting room, and we have access to another long room over a former milking parlour in another very old building, which where we have group visits.
Is that pretty steady for you, having cider tourists coming through?
It could be. We tend not to do too many of them because they tend to want to happen at the weekends, and we do a lot of events at the weekend when we're selling direct to the public away from our own premises. Which is kind of where you get groups of people. It's where your market is in the UK during the summer is outdoor events.
I see.
So those are what we tend to focus on because that's where the greater number of people are.
Right.
But the whole operation is based in a farm that was where the farmhouse was built in the mid-17th century. So I think the date on the building is the 1650s.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of history there.
Yeah, which is quite interesting because, as I understand it, historically, the keeving process or the use of keeving also started in the 17th century.
Mm.
So it's kind of a nice historical link where we are to what we do and how we operate.
Right, which is the perfect segue to get into talking about keeving. Mm. Why don't we start from the beginning, what keeving is?
Essentially, fermentation is often considered to be a two-element process. And the two elements that are commonly recognised in fermentation are the yeast, and the other one is the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But what we as cider makers, I hope, all know is that that fermentation is actually a three-legged stool, and the third leg is our nutrients, the nitrogenous compounds in the apple juice.
Okay.
And The way I view it is that those nutrients are akin to a human being's vitamins and minerals. So they're a something that helps the yeast to live and operate and do its work at metabolizing sugar into alcohol. The way I often explain keeving to people is, if I were to sit you as a human being in front of a big mountain of sugar and say, right, you can eat as much of this as you want, but I'm not going to give you any fruit and vegetables, you might live for a little while, but there will come a point where you'll keel over and die because you've got no vitamins and minerals entering your body. Mm-hmm. And effectively, that's what we're doing in the keeving process. We're taking away the nutrient from the yeast. So the yeast is struggling to find its vitamins and minerals, so it doesn't operate in a very effective way and eventually starts to die, or at least work very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of basic overview of the theory, if you like. But the keeving itself is the process by which we are removing nutrient from the pressed juice. So
right at that initial stage, too.
Before fermentation starts,
right.
Or as fermentation starts, mm-hmm. Technically. But
it's a little bit like when people are melting butter for different styles, where they kind of make the ghee and take off the very top. You kind of boil it up, and then you scrape it across a little mm-hmm. bit. That's kind of pulling it out to really thin out the butter. I don't know if that's a good analysis, but
it is a very technical pursuit. And I would say, before we even start talking about keeving, we have to bear in mind that keeving will only remove so much nutrient from juice. Mm. So the first part of keeving is locating or asking growers to produce for you low nutrient fruit. Mm. Because if you haven't got low nutrient fruit, it almost doesn't matter how good your keeving is, it will never be a properly keeved cider.
So what would be a typical apple that would be a low nutrient apple then?
In the UK, we tend to use obviously bittersweet fruit for keeving.
Right. Yeah.
And there are a number of reasons for that. Partly, we don't want the environment to be too acidic, because it does inhibit the action of the enzymes we use in the keeving process.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we need to have a temperature, because we work at ambient temperature, we don't really refrigerate anything. We need the temperature of the juice to be at a certain level for keeving to work properly. And normally it's between about 8 and 10 degrees centigrade.
Okay.
Now, if you consider that you probably need a kind of, that's probably going to be the average day to night temperature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the UK, we start to see the temperature, average temperature dropping to that level in early November.
Ah.
So that tends to dictate what fruit you can use.
Right.
And early November is when we are starting to see the heavy-duty, late-season bittersweet start to come mm-hmm. become ripe.
Mm.
So that's another reason why they're used. But basically, it's unfertilized orchards. Also, one of the things we like about those Taunton Cider Company orchards is the trees have been in the ground for 40 years. So over that time, the trees have denuded the soil of much of the natural nutrient in the soil.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Naturally, you tend to get very low nutrient fruit,
right.
Which is great for us.
Cider Chat is brought to you by Cider Cellars Imports. Ciders made on the farm from traditional apple varieties like King's Favourite, Porter's Perfection, Buttery Door, Brown Snout, Foxwhelp, Stoke Red and Yarlington Mill. Bringing traditional British craft ciders to America.
Try saying that when you've had a few ciders.
So the keeving process Would you like me to explain it in
Please.
Some kind of detail?
Yes,
well,
I would.
It does take many. It probably took me 5 or 6 years of experiments before we were starting to get something that was relatively consistent.
Interesting.
So it does take time.
And were you doing this in like 5 gallon kind of, or were you
I was doing it in small quantities.
Right.
And the other thing I was doing is I was doing it in glass.
Right.
Because it's a process that you need, while you're learning about it, you need to be able to watch it.
See it, right.
You need to see what's happening.
Right.
Because once you understand what's happening, it's a bit less important that you see it in great detail. But while you're learning, you really, really do need to watch what's happening.
When, can I just ask you, before you start that, explain that process, you came into cider making, what I saw on the website, a bit of a hobby. So I'm imagining that you didn't go right into making, you know, cider using the keeping process that you're, or did you?
No, I was probably 2-3 years maybe into the start of my cider making before I started having a go at keeving. One of the problems in the UK that has now been resolved, but at the time was a problem, was finding sources of the enzyme that you need to add.
Right.
You could buy it in 54-gallon drums for several thousand pounds, but if you just wanted a few drops to try keeving, it was problematical.
Right. Not so tough now. There are now people
who do it. And in actual fact, the enzyme is used in fruit processing, other fruit processing industries. They tend to use it in the canning of strawberries because it helps to keep the fruit firm during the canning process.
Interesting.
So the way that I do it, and I think probably everyone's going to have to find their own way of doing this, but the way I do it is we source the fruit, we make sure the temperature is right, we wait for the fruit to be as ripe as we possibly dare let it get, because that means, again, you've managed to reduce the nutrient further by allowing the ripening process to use some of it up.
Very good, yeah.
And we then press the fruit. Now, conventional wisdom is that you should mill the fruit and allow it to macerate for around about 12 hours before you press it. When we started this process of learning about keeving, at the time we'd outgrown our pressing equipment and somebody else was pressing for us, and I didn't feel I could really ask them to do a 12-hour maceration between milling and pressing. And funnily enough, we started getting successful keeves without any maceration. So I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's to do with the type of fruit that we get, or its ripeness or whatever. But we now get successful keeves most of the time without using any maceration.
Interesting.
Now, I'm probably going to get hammered for saying that, but that's the truth.
May it always be so.
Yes. So once the juice is pressed, you can add this enzyme called PME. I'm not a great chemist, but I believe it stands for pectin methylesterase. You can add it to the pulp before you press it. And I think particularly if you are going to macerate, that's probably a good idea. We just add it to the juice as soon as it's pressed. And there is then a period when the enzyme needs to propagate through the rest of the juice, through the whole body of the juice. And that, again, seems to be very dependent on temperature, how fast that process happens. So in order to determine whether or not that process is complete, you need to do a series of tests where you're adding to a small test sample a sample of calcium chloride in solution. Mm-hmm. You do those test additions to the test samples every, depending on how cold it is, probably every 12 hours, maybe every 24 hours. If it's very cold, every 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Until when you add the calcium chloride solution, you get an instant, it kind of goes like a snow globe. You get a kind of instant sediment, not a sediment,
precipitance.
A precipitation, yeah.
Yeah, right, good job.
And so you know immediately that that's then ready for the bulk of the calcium chloride to be added to the mm-hmm. juice. At that point, this was a little tip that I picked up from by kind of translating in my schoolboy French pamphlet that I received with some keeping equipment that I had sent over from France. Mm. And I managed to work out that what they were saying was you then had to cycle the juice through your pump for an hour or about
really
an hour
mix it
to
in.
Make sure it's really mixed.
If you had like a 5 gallon, or well, you're doing liters, I'm not sure how it translates, but a small batch.
Yeah.
Shaking it
you
up.
Could shake it, or yeah. you could just have a small pump going round and round.
Sure.
But yeah,
yeah,
any. I think the lesson is that you do need to agitate it, and you do need
right.
to distribute the calcium chloride through the body of the juice, and perhaps for longer than you think.
Uh-huh.
And now we tend to do this in 1,000 litre batches, and in an IBC. So
yeah.
you can see. We tend to shine a light through the plastic, and you can see that there are solids in suspension throughout the
wow.
throughout the juice. And the minute you turn the pump off, it slowly, all these kind of flecks of what is effectively a gel
mm-hmm.
start to slowly fall to the bottom of the container.
Mm-hmm.
And that process may take quite a long time as well. But they will gradually, over a period of a day or so, settle to the bottom of the container. They may not be very well compressed as a layer.
Mm-hmm. But it's kind of glutinous, isn't it? It's like a pectin.
It's a pectin gel. Yeah.
yeah.
So it's at that time it's whitish.
Mm.
It's not very compact on the bottom. But the next phase of the process is the start of fermentation. And this is why one of the reasons you need it to be so cold, or it needs to be at that particular temperature of around about 10 degrees, because it will allow a slow fermentation to start.
Right.
But the other thing you need to bear in mind there is if you've sulfited the juice beforehand, the chances are you won't have enough of the early starting yeasts to get that early fermentation going.
Right.
So.
Don't sulfite?
I tend not to sulfite at that stage.
Okay. Yeah. So no sulfites.
No.
Right.
So you know.
Good tip.
So
yeah.
Then if you think we aren't going to sulfite at that stage, the way I look at that is that's a bit of a risk. So
right.
we want to make sure that the containers are really, really clean, and make sure that we're only bringing in yeast that comes in with the juice rather than whatever else might mm-hmm. be going on mm-hmm. bacterially or mm-hmm. Inside that vessel.
You've had that the pectin has dropped down, has become glutinous. You take the liquid out and put it into... No,
not at this point.
Wow, okay.
No,
right.
So it's... Just going back a stage, if we're not going to add sulfite, we want to make sure the containers are very clean.
Mm-hmm.
We also want to make sure the pH is probably as low as we think we can get away with. If you take some French ciders from Normandy or Brittany and start testing their titratable acidity or their pH, mm-hmm. you'll find that the pH is incredibly high.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect this probably... Well, say actually, it's the TA that's incredibly high. So I think working backwards from they've had a malolactic fermentation, at the end. So working backwards from that, we tried to kind of work out roughly where we thought the TA ought to be.
And TA means?
Titratable acidity, which is it's more a measure of how your sense of taste perceives sharpness rather than pH, which is more of a chemical or a biological measure of acidity, how things operate in that environment, if you like. So at this stage, right, we've probably got something around about 3.8 pH. We've got a layer of goop on the bottom of our container, and a very slow, probably apiculate yeast fermentation.
What are you calling it?
They're apiculate yeast. Oh. They're what I would call the starting yeasts, just so that we know. If you do sulfite, you won't get that type of yeast, so let's not sulfite at that point. So the apiculate yeast are starting to just create a little bit of carbon dioxide that gets caught in the layer of gel that's on the base of the container, and slowly that the layer starts to rise, it starts to float through the bulk of the juice. Yeah. Now, this is I always think this is the really magic part of the process, because it's that gel is charged. So I can never remember if it's positively or negatively charged, but basically it's the opposite charge of all the other stuff that's in the in the juice. So as it rises through the container, it attracts all the particulates in the juice. So all the little tiny bits of apple and of apple flesh and yeast and. The thing about the yeast is as it starts to reproduce, as each cell is born, if you like, it tends to try and attach itself to a piece of nutrient, to a molecule of nutrient. So essentially this gel is sucking yeast and nutrient towards itself, and slowly, if it's going at the right nice slow speed, it may take a few days, and suddenly you'll go and look at it one day and everything will be all these solids will be on the top of the container, floating on the top.
I so want to see that.
it is quite the first time you see it is quite frightening, and I would say the first time I did it in a 1,000-litre container, I put far too much juice in. And it blew the top off the container, and it started to kind of creep out like lava out of the top of the container. And I knew, because I came out of the house in the morning to go to work, and all I could smell coming from the garage was this incredible smell of apples. And I opened the door, and it was kind of like
Shop of Horrors, movie coming out of you. Wow.
something in a horror movie, definitely, like working its way towards the door. So we do leave a little bit of headspace these days.
In a glass container, if somebody was doing this, a small batch, how much headspace do you think would be
You don't need to leave too much.
It's going to be about 2 inches thick, an inch?
I just think that when it first comes up to the surface, it's not very compressed, this material. So it seems to take up... Maybe when it's at the bottom of the vessel, the pressure of the liquid on top of it makes it less volumetric. But as it rises to the surface, it's not under so much pressure, so it expands.
Right.
So obviously it's not going to make a massive amount of difference, but probably I'd perhaps leave 10% of the vessel clear on the top.
That's a good tip. Sure.
You'll find that when it first flies, when the flying lees, as the English cider makers used to call it, when the lees first fly, they'll probably take up 25 to 30% of the height of the vessel that you've got them in, got the juice in. But as time goes by, that layer on the top starts to compress.
Yeah,
and it's quite.
And that's a chemical reaction doing that, isn't it?
No, I don't. I think it's a physical.
Physical.
I think it's a physical thing. So
this air and space.
It's kind of as more carbon dioxide is produced underneath it starts to lift more.
Fascinating.
And so squashes it together, and it does actually look like the layer
or the Chapeau Brun, as the French rather artistically call it, is called, it looks like an omelette, really, like a brown omelette.
Yes, or, from the pictures I've seen,
And the part of the omelette that's exposed to the air on the top of the vessel oxidizes quite a lot, so you get a very dark colour, but underneath it will be a lighter brown. And I think this is the point where a lot of people get it wrong. Because you really need to let it compress as much as possible before you start trying to remove the juice from underneath the cap. And people are generally scared that a fast fermentation is going to take hold. But if you've got low nutrient fruit, if you do get a very fast fermentation happening, there's probably one of two things going on. It's either too warm, in which case there's not going to be a lot you can do about it unless you refrigerate the juice. Or the kieve hasn't worked very well and you've got a lot more nutrient in there than you actually need, or you started with too much nutrient in the juice. So essentially, if you get a fast fermentation taking hold, it's not really worth worrying too much about it, because the chances are it's not going to be a very successful kieve anyway.
Can you still use that juice, though?
You can use it, but once a fast fermentation takes hold, it will destroy the cap, and the cap will then go back into the cider.
Messy.
The thing about the cap is that's where all the nutrient is trapped, attached to the yeast. So if that cap breaks up, then that nutrient goes back into the cycle of fermentation. So you've not really controlled that fermentation. But I know, you know, you can make normal cider out of it. I mean, bear in mind, you have added a salt of calcium to it. So I mean, it could potentially be slightly salty tasting cider, but it's perfectly, you know, people do it. So
I imagine, you know, the sky's the limit, and somebody listening to this might kind of have that next stage of keeving.
Does happen, it happens. You know, you've got to look at your process, and the next time you try it, do it in a different way, or find different fruit, or, you know, but
So you have the, like you were saying, the French, because is this a French technique originally?
I think it was originally an English technique. I always say, and I only say this because my brother-in-law is French and I like to wind him up a little bit, but the French cider makers, spent a lot more time working on kieving, I suspect, because it means you can make us a sweet, fizzy, and more valuable product without actually owning any expensive equipment.
So anyway, at that point,
I would also always counsel people to try to be brave and leave it as long as you can. Because even when it looks like there's a fermentation that's getting a bit stronger, if it's at the right temperature, the chances are you've probably got a couple of days.
A couple of days, 5 days, because, or 3 days? And if you wait too long?
I just think, you've got to learn. This is what I mean about you have to do it in glass and watch what's going on. And you've got, in a way, you need to make mistakes. You're not going to get it right first time. Or if you do, it's luck.
You're damn lucky, yeah.
So really what you want to do almost is do some experiments in glass. And let them go too far so that you can see what the stages are prior to it becoming too late. Because if you take it out too early, the chances are the cap might break up. You just seem to get a more complete kieve if you're a bit braver. So if you're brave enough to leave it, and you've got a nice solid cap, what I then do is I will break open the cap in the middle and insert a tube, and then pump the clarified juice out from underneath the cap. At this point, you start to understand why you need to have a parallel-sided container. because if you don't, then the cap will break up as you're removing the juice. But actually, if you have been brave and left it to get very, very solid, very compressed, you'll be surprised how well that cap hangs together as you drop it down through the vessel, as you pump the liquid out from underneath. And also, again, I'll say you don't want the tube to be right on the floor of the vessel, because there will be some
something there.
There will be some sediment there, and the chances are that will contain yeast and it will contain nutrients. You're trying to remove the nutrients from the cycle at that stage. But anyway, that's just the first stage. Do you want to know any more details? Starting to get bored now?
No, I'm not bored at all. I'm loving this. I feel like a kid in a candy store.
So the next stage is you will let the pump the juice into a new container, a clean container, and it doesn't. You will lose some of the volume. You probably lose 15 to 20% of your original volume of juice.
Juice, right?
People do ask occasionally what you do with the chapeau bras. I say, well, I kind of flush it down the drain, because it's not really very nice. People say they do cook with it, but you know, it's the juice I'm after, really.
Yeah.
So pump the juice, and you might have a bit of headspace if you've got the same size container that you're pumping it into that you did the original keeving in, but that doesn't actually matter in this case, because we've got fermentation going on. And then you just have to let it take its course for a bit, and you do a weekly. I tend to do a weekly gravity check, so I'm checking how fast the fermentation is progressing.
What is the gravity typically when you begin? Before you're doing the fermentation,
you want. That's a good point, because if you consider the physical processes of getting the cap to rise to the surface of the vessel, the denser the liquid is, i.e. the more sugar it's got, the better it will rise. So generally speaking, the guidance is that you really want juice at about a gravity of about 105.4 or above.
This is pre-keeving?
Pre-keeving.
Okay.
And that helps with the cap formation. Mm-hmm. But then you do need to watch the fermentation, because although you've taken some of the nutrient out of the cycle, you may not have taken enough out of the cycle, and effectively you're then doing a normal fermentation, just very much slower than usual.
Right.
So you will get a build-up on the bottom of yeast and of working yeast cells, and they will be attaching to the a remaining nutrient in the juice. So if it looks like the fermentation is going too fast, you then can rack again. So you're taking the juice off the sediment on the bottom just to slow it down again.
Interesting. Yeah.
And then really you come to the really skillful bit.
Oh dear.
Which is when you're trying to effectively, you know, you're trying to land the fermentation. I always think of it as kind of trying to land an aeroplane, really. So you're trying to slow down the fermentation to such a level that your sugar graph against, or your density graph against time, if you're plotting that graph, will land in the, just above where you want the sweetness to be in the bottle.
Right.
So about 5 points. You want to put it in the bottle 5 points above where it's going to land. So you have to try and project that curve. And if it's going too fast, you'll see that the gradient will take it. If you can kind of plot where you think it's going to finish, and if it's going to finish too dry for what you're trying to achieve, then you need to rack it, and that will then slow it down again.
How often have you ever put it in the bottle and then had to take it out?
No. I tend to err on the other side.
Okay.
So I will tend to try and make sure that the fermentation is more finished than perhaps you should. Because I tried it the other way. And it's not very productive.
Oh dear.
So you don't take the cider out of the bottle, the cider takes itself out of the
bottle. That's a good, yeah,
and,
sure.
And I think the other thing that you need, I mean, this is the critical decision is when you put it in the bottle.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have experimented with sulfiting at that stage.
Okay.
Lightly before you bottle.
Right.
And that does seem to work. I mean, we're literally only talking probably 10, 15 parts per million.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's literally just to give it a little bit of a safety net.
Right.
But the thing we need to bear in mind with Kieve cider in the bottle is it's still a live product. And although people talk about stability, and all this is, you know, this is a stable cider now, right, it's in the bowl.
Right.
Those processes never really completely stop.
Yes.
They just slow down.
Right.
So they're almost imperceptible, but right, they are right, still happening.
Right.
So I would rather put the cider in the bottle almost too late.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means that it's more safe, and eventually it will become carbonated. It may take a bit longer, but right, really, like a lot of real cider making activities, the longer it's within reason, the longer it's in the bottle, the better it is anyway. So you don't really want to be selling it after, mm-hmm, 2 weeks anyway.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, we will normally bottle stuff in July, at the start of July,
mm-hmm,
and not start selling it till Christmas at the earliest.
Wow.
But if you do it like that, you tend to get a nice level of carbonation that's very well, mm-hmm, dissolved,
mm-hmm,
and you get a really nice light mousse,
mm-hmm,
that stays. You get very small bubbles,
mm-hmm,
and it tends to stay in the liquid a long time. And of course the other trick is to use proper cider bouchée corks. So we don't use champagne corks, we use small corks,
because
and the other thing we do is we don't mushroom the tops.
Oh.
And this is all part of the same story.
Right.
So we put we use a narrow cork that isn't very long, and you can put that in manually with the right equipment.
Right, sure.
And then as you put there, we tend to just squash the top of the cork a little bit, just put a little bit of downward pressure on the cork with a crown capper before we do up the cage. So we put the wire cage on.
Right.
Put some downward pressure on the cork, then we put the cage on, and that just puts a little bit of tension in the wires.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason we do that, and we also store the bottles upright with the corks facing the ceiling, because if they're, as the pressure builds up in the bottles, the small corks allow any excess pressure to escape.
Fantastic.
So you end up, it's kind of a self-limiting system where the fit of the cork, the mechanical size of the cork dictates how much pressure is in the bottle and therefore how fizzy the product is.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you can find a cork that matches your requirement for fizz,
mm-hmm,
that seems to be the kind of
right,
the factor, the limiting factor.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
And we know that as well because, okay, in the past, we accidentally stored some cartons of bottles upside down because we didn't have a label on the box, and they were very, very lively indeed. So that, I think, demonstrates to me that this escape of carbon dioxide is happening.
Right.
And if you have the bottles on their side or upside down and it can't get out,
right,
you do run into problems,
yes,
because that process is still happening all the time.
Right, right. A fantastic tip. And that other question I had was of the fermentation. So you're bottling in July and you just, how long, it's a very slow fermentation. So how many months?
Again, it's
March to July, is it something like that?
What to ferment? Or, the initial fermentation.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry, using longer than March.
Initial fermentation, yeah, will be
December.
November.
Okay.
Until the fermentation is still going.
Right.
And even in the bottle, it's still going.
A half a year, if more.
Yeah, but it's something you need to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
And you don't want it to go too far or too fast. Mm. Control the fermentation, get it in the bottle at the right time. Mm. And then if you've put it in quite late, like we tend to do, then it will take longer to condition in the bottle, mm-hmm. but you will get a better finish.
You know, keeving, the fact that cider can be keeved and is, really separates it from wine, because it makes cider now be a live food, just as like a craft beer can be a live mm-hmm. food. Mm-hmm. But you don't see that with wine.
And I think there's a good reason for that, and that is that in general wine is fermented with cultivated yeasts, mm-hmm. and with the best will in the world, there's no way you can control a cultivated yeast mm-hmm. fermentation once it gets going. It's like dropping an anvil out of an aeroplane. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can't stop it. It's
right.
going, and you come back when it's finished.
Right.
And that's one of the great joys of using wild yeast, is that they are lazier. And that gives you the opportunity to manipulate their behaviour, mm-hmm. which you can't do with cultivated yeast.
Right, right.
And as almost all wine is made with cultivated yeast, then that's probably why. Although, having said that, there is an Italian tradition of making a carbonated wine, name which is currently escaping me, but they do bottle it sweet and live.
Okay.
Yeah, and
okay.
the way they can they seem to control it using temperature, so they tend to ferment it in chilled.
I see.
And I'm not quite quite sure what happens
after that.
I suspect they may add a chemical to try and limit the further fermentation.
Wow.
But not in the champagne. Certainly, champagne is not made in the same way at all as keeved cider.
Not at all. Yeah, really fascinating.
Thank you, Neil, for sharing your wealth of knowledge on keeving cider. And thank you to Cider Cellars Imports for sponsoring this podcast. You could reach them at cidercellars.com. And remember, that's a cellars as in the place that you keep your cider. What a treasure trove of info that is now available to Ciderville. Because there are so many cider making tips in this chat, I had it transcribed into a 15-page document that you can refer to when trying your hand at keeving. This transcript is yours for the keeping, and I can send it directly to your email address. In return, I ask of you to support this podcast by becoming a patron of Cider Chat. Patrons who support this chat for only $3 or more per month will receive a copy of this transcript with Neil on keeving cider. And becoming a patron is really easy. I'll provide a link to Cider Chat's Patreon page in the show notes to this episode, which is number 26. Or you could Google Cider Chat Patreon page. That's PATREON. And it's a website that helps content creators like myself generate funds to allow me to continue providing valuable chats like our chat with Neil Worley on keeving. I know you love this chat, and I love you too, Ciderville. So please support Cider Chat and become a patron today. Hoo-wee, what a chat, and so many great ones to come. I'll be talking to the folks at Farnham Hill in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and to Sam Reed in Tasmania, Australia, at Willie Smith's. Ooh, so much more to do, Ciderville. I'm so happy to have you along. This is Rio Windcaller signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
My advice would be to pick up on Ria's Cider Chat podcast. She said that was the most interesting discussion I've ever had, Neil. As the tears rolled down my cheek. I would thoroughly recommend
That's awesome.
That you listen to tonight.